This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's the 21st of March, a little past 6 o'clock in the morning. We're taking you up all the way to 10 o'clock in the morning. Brian, how are you feeling this morning?
Oh, good, actually. I really had a good night's sleep last night for a change.
Great. Okay. Well, some people are not having such a great night because of the way in which this particular rhino's survival is at stake. The northern white rhino, the last male Sudanese northern white rhino, has died, and leaving behind two females of the species, who are descendants of that particular male. It looks like this species or subspecies is going to be extinct very soon.
Well, that's very sad, but hopefully through methods like IVF, there may be hope still for the white rhino.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? So the modern technology might actually be able to preserve, if nothing, they'll be able to preserve some part of that rhino. Maybe in future technologies might be able to return that population back to life.
The only challenge is, of course, the gene pool is very limited. So essentially, the females are his daughter, as you mentioned, his daughter and his granddaughter. So the gene pool is a rather limited one.
Yeah, well, you know, okay, moving on to China. China actually has some amazing wildlife. I was just looking at a video recently on there's actually a documentary, Brian, on Netflix about China's wildlife. But before we get to that, this is much more a political story. This is about Xi Jinping. Recently had the two-term limit lifted. He has warned of any attempts to split China, and he's referring specifically to the Taiwan question, because we visited that Taiwan question in a recent grill.
Yeah, that's right. And also one of the things is this is part of the two-week Chinese Communist Party Congress that just ended. One of the key takeaways is also the fact that China was actually going to start opening up its economy even further to both domestic as well as foreign firms. So it'll be interesting to see how this pans out moving forward.
Okay, and back to the United States and Washington and the White House, which is giving us no end of stories. Stormy Daniels, that name that strikes you. Stormy Daniels, a woman caught up in a sex scandal involving the current president of the United States, Donald Trump. She's taken a polygraph test, and that polygraph test, that tests whether you're telling the truth or lying, says that she, in fact, is truthful when she says that she had sex with the now president of the United States.
Yeah, so this is a scandal that keeps getting bigger and bigger. This latest polygraph test obviously puts Donald Trump in not a very good light.
Well, you know, the thing about Donald Trump is that coming into that election, I mean, his views on women, his views on a whole range of things. In fact, I think at one point he said, I could shoot somebody dead in Central Square and, you know, I'm untouchable. And I think because he feels he's untouchable, that maybe this is one of those storms in a teacup. It's a Stormy Daniels teacup.
And also, we've got to point out that polygraphs are not admissible in court. So, you know, that in terms of evidence and stuff like that in the U.S.
At least our politicians aren't behaving as badly. We'll come back with a look at national pride. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Down Under by the Australian band Men at Work. That's an early 80s hit. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Time to look at our sportsmen and women in particular who have been doing the country proud by going out there in the world and, participating in so many contests. They don't always win. And the question is, when they don't win, you know, do we feel lesser about them?
Well, you see, the thing is, so I used to be an athlete before and competitively. And I understand that, you know, a lot of times it's very hard.
Was it running? Were you in the running event?
Yes, I was in athletics. I've also played badminton competitively as well. And it's always hard, and I empathize with these athletes because it's very hard to be consistent in your performance.
It's hard to be a champ every time, isn't it?
Well, I wasn't a champ, but these people are, you know, they're international level athletes.
Okay, so we actually were reflecting on the performance of Noor Dabita Sabri. She was at a World Series Diving Championship recently, and she didn't win anything, and she felt the need to apologize, and the 19-year-old came out to say that despite her failures in Beijing, China, and Fuji, Japan, it would not break her spirit, and she promised to do better. And I feel bad because they always, because athletes are always put in a position of having to apologize to the nation. And you know, do you feel that this is unfair? And you know, on the other side, I mean, do we put too much on them because our pride in them is so performance dependent?
Of course, I think you're right about that. I think in general, for the general population, we only feel pride for them if they're winning. If they're not winning, obviously,
is it unreasonable?
I think that's a normal thing to do. If you've been competing before, you will understand that, you know, competition's about ups and downs. It depends on your performance, depends on whether you're peaking at the right time. There are many issues that affect performance. So when you don't perform and you're not up to the mark, I think psychologically, it really disturbs you a lot.
Right. You know, what's in fact very disturbing for me, Brian, is that you didn't ask me if I've ever been a competitive sports person. I don't know why. I mean, looking at me, you think that would be a natural question.
I don't know. You could have been a world-class athlete in a previous life. I don't know.
He's only crediting me with, you know, having done well in a previous life. Now, the thing is, should we change attitudes about sports and sportsmen and women and be much more generous?
I think so, because one of the things we need to do is sports is a great way to build character, and as part of encouraging our children and even each other to participate in sports, I think we should be less critical. We should really be more supportive.
And how would we do that, do you think? I mean, you know, what would go into it? I mean, I'm thinking that perhaps the idea would be to not have our leaders use events, especially wins, as, you know, reasons to give out perhaps public holidays. I mean, if if the public is trained to believe that a win at an event will give them personal benefits, maybe they're trained then to kind of only think of the sportsman as having that value to them.
But also, Sharad, I mean, that's a valid point, but also, one of the things with that is the fact that if there's an incentive for them, then there's also an incentive to follow the sport and watch the sport. Otherwise, I don't think many people will be watching diving.
Oh, really? Why not? It's an extraordinary, beautiful sport. If you remember divers like Greg Louganis, I mean, an extraordinary athlete.
Yeah, from a while ago.
It is from a while ago, but a while ago had great things. You know, old is gold, as they say. That's a bit of a cliche, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, so Greg Louganis is a very good example. I mean, he leveraged his diving career into, I think, movies as well as, I think, acting. And also
a book. He had a book about his person and about his life. Now, you can be part of this conversation at any point in time. Tell us what you think about sports and our attitudes towards our national sportsmen and women. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Oh, by the way, we do have a poll on Twitter, and the question is, do you think you and others have been manipulated by targeted propaganda and psychological warfare? This is because coming out of that global discussion about the role of the organization Cambridge Analytica in manipulating elections around the world. So remember, be part of the Twitter poll. We'll be back with a look at Malaysians suffering from depression. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Fleetwood Mac, and it's a 1977 hit, Dreams. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. We were talking about pride just now in our sports, women and men. Now, time to talk about shame, the shame some of us feel. And the person that's at the heart of a particular storm now brewing is Datin Rosita Mohamed Ali.
Yeah, so later today, an application will be made at the Shah Alam High Court to review the sentence meted out against her. And she caused grievous hurt to her domestic worker. So earlier this week, the Petaling Jaya Sessions Court meted out a bond over 5 years of good behavior bond of 20,000 ringgit on her. So essentially, it was just a slap in the wrist, Sharad.
Okay, and that's how a lot of people felt about it. Not only individuals, but also some organizations, including our National Human Rights Commission, Suhakam. They issued a statement with regard to this particular case. What's happened is 50,000 people have signed a petition demanding equal justice for rich and poor. That's the frame of that petition, that somehow this is about the fact that she has a datinship, that she is somebody
she's
of
wealthy
note.
and influential.
That's the presumption. Do you think, you know, that the motivations at 50,000 come from a sense of injustice, or is it a question of shame? You know, we have done badly against somebody from a neighboring country.
I think, Sharad, it's probably a combination of both. I think, personally, I just feel a sense of injustice, you know, because this person has been committed such a crime, yet has only literally been just given a slap in the wrist.
Yeah, if you remember the crime, right? So grievous hurt, when it was detailed, just the kind of implements used against the young Indonesian woman was just extraordinary. And the pictures of her that have gone viral of her face, you know, she's just all swollen and puffy from that beating that she took. And of course, we know that this is coming on the heels of that other case of a family that beat their abused their maid so badly that she, in fact, died. So it can sometimes lead to murder, this grievous hurt, right, if left unattended.
Exactly. So the question is, Sharad, you know, how should we in society deal with this? This is obviously also a more prevalent problem than most people will want to recognize.
Right. You know, the great 19th century thinker Karl Marx once wrote, "Shame is a revolutionary sentiment." It's an extraordinary statement to make. But in some ways, I think it's meaningful that people can be motivated and often motivated by very primal feelings. Right? And shame is one of those primal feelings. I think, yes, there is a sense of outrage, but shame goes to the heart of who you are, right? So in some ways, you know, sense of wanting justice is about wanting to change the world and things outside. But shame is deeply personal.
Yeah, and what I don't understand is this. How do they see, how can they justify any sort of action or abuse against a fellow human being? I mean, that's a basic human instinct. Why do you want to hurt someone?
Yeah, so I think so that maybe, I'm not quite sure how the Dutton pleaded, if she pleaded guilty or not guilty, but it was also the mind of the court, right? So what was the judge thinking when he handed down that sentence? You travel around the region, I travel around, lots of people travel around the region. When you encounter people from other countries and they've had a bad time here, you know, doesn't it make you feel, doesn't it fill you with a sense of shame?
Sharad, absolutely. Because I've actually encountered someone, I think when I went to Cambodia a number of years ago, and that person actually mentioned, I think it was a service staff in a restaurant, and they actually mentioned the fact that, oh, you know, Cambodians are not well treated in Malaysia. And I felt a very deep sense of shame.
Right. I've had that same thing, same encounter in Vietnam, in Indonesia. You know, I always feel that I have to apologize for the way in which, I mean, this is not the vast majority of Malaysians, but a minority of Malaysians who behave so badly that, you know, I feel automatically, by default, shamed that I'm from a country that abuses people from other countries.
But, you know, as Malaysians, what can we do to tackle this issue? Because, you know, this is something which I think is such a big problem. And it is a big problem. It's been swept under the carpet for so many years.
Yeah. And
what can we do?
Yeah, so I think there are multiple solutions out there in the world. There are best practices when it comes to dealing with this issue, including the avoiding the one of the things, the key conditions to allow this abuse to take place, which is that the maid is in some sense trapped in the home of her employer. So, right, and because of that, she's at their beck and call 24/7. she can be abused without being, and that abuse being not visible to others just because she's in that home.
So is what you're suggesting the fact that they're live-in maids, that's a big part of this
issue?
Don't
you think?
I think that could be, but I think the fact that we must have stronger labor laws and legislation to protect these people, restrict their working hours.
And how would you do that if they lived in their house of their employer?
Yeah, for example, for many households, I think, who treat their, and this is probably the majority, who treat their maids well and as human beings, they probably, you know, after dinner say, hey, don't disturb this person, that they need some quiet time and so forth. That should be a way that people treat their maids.
So they start at breakfast and end at dinner. Now, that's an extraordinarily long day. Yeah. Tell us what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 and tell us what you think is the solution to this problem. We'll be back with a look at the story of Cambridge Analytica. Remember, there's a Twitter poll going on, taking us up to the first bulletin of the morning. Charles Bradley with "The World is Going Up in Flames." Is it really? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. "It's Still Rock and Roll to Me" by Billy Joel. I'm sure I'd put with me Brian Fernandez. You know, Billy Joel, Brian, is in his late 60s, about 68 years old.
Yeah, amazing. I always think of Billy Joel in terms of Christy Brinkley, whom he married for a period of time.
Oh, you would, wouldn't you? Okay, thanks to everybody for weighing in on those stories that we've covered, especially the one on maids. We had Dr. Jagjeet from Penang, who listens to BFM on his BFM app, and he says, and he brings a very interesting angle to the question of employee relationships with regard to maids. He says, employers have a tendency to develop a lot of anger towards maids when the levy fees imposed end up being ridiculously high. It makes for a bad start to begin with. And that's an interesting angle, how employers might be projecting their anger onto maids. Also, Raphael says that he believes that live-in maids should be outlawed. But others say, well, if agents did their part, by doing spot checks, for instance, on employers, this abuse might be lessened or mitigated. So let's move on to the next story, and that's about Cambridge Analytica. You might not have known this name until recently, but it's on everybody's lips across the world. It's a global story in which Malaysia plays a part. Now, a top official at the data analytics firm revealed in an interview on Britain's Channel 4 television station that his company has done electioneering work in Malaysia. The Channel 4 news team, in fact, caught executives at Cambridge Analytica saying that, one, they could extort politicians, two, send women to entrap them, and three, help proliferate propaganda to help their clients. Now, to understand how Cambridge Analytica works, here's the suspended CEO, Alexander Nix, explaining how data analytics and behavioral micro-targeting are applied to political campaigns.
In the simplest form, the more you know about someone, the more you can align a campaign with their requirements or their wants and needs. Mm-hmm. We try and take a really very vast quantity of demographic, consumer and lifestyle data, and we blend that with psychographic data, which is a modeling of personality, to start to be able to target and communicate with people about the things that they really, really care about, but more importantly, possibly in a way that resonates with their personalities. So you can take one specific issue and communicate it in multiple ways to different audiences, depending on their personalities, to achieve engagement on that issue.
That was Alexander Nix, the suspended CEO of Cambridge Analytica, and that clip was taken from a presentation he did back in 2015. We do, in fact, have a Twitter poll, Brian, and it reads, do you think you and others have been manipulated by targeted propaganda and psychological warfare? The options are no, no one has, I haven't, others have, yes, everybody has. So for 100% of people who've taken the poll, say they believe they, in fact, and others have been manipulated by propaganda.
Okay, I'm surprised that everyone is overwhelmingly in favor of that. I believe that as well. I think that we've all been manipulated now because of all the inputs that we actually put on social media. So they basically, companies and who are targeting consumers and individuals and so forth are able to really derive very rich information from just stuff that we're putting in every day.
Yeah, but you know, the manipulation of individuals, of mass society, has been happening for 100 years. If you think of, you know, Sigmund Freud's nephew was actually took his views and turned it into public relations. Public relations used to be called propaganda. In World War I, it was called propaganda, the propaganda department. They turned it to public relations. Public relations is built on winning hearts and minds or manipulating people's ideas or feelings towards a particular end, often to buy products, but also in terms of their politics.
Yeah, and so, Sharad, social media has just taken that to a really different level altogether, because I think the ability to analyze in such depth, because if you think about the past, I think the tools were not available to do it to that extent. The sample sizes tended to be a bit smaller as well.
I don't think people are robots, though, and I don't think the manipulation is perfectly executable. So when these consultants try and sell their services to political parties, and because there's a big debate about who used them in this country and such, it's not, they're obviously going to talk it up as if it was a simple question of applying these methods and you'll get your results. I don't think that's true. There is a bit of a brag going on here. It's a much more complex story. If Kedar was won simply on Cambridge Analytica's targeting of populations, it discounts the fact that the previous government, Pakatan Rakyat, led by PAS, did a dismal job. Perhaps if they didn't do a dismal job, the targeted messaging wouldn't work.
I think that point, I think I take your point, Sharad, because winning elections is about many, many factors. This tool, these tools, these psychological tools that you use to then manipulate audiences and stuff like that, are just one of the bullets that parties have in terms of trying to get the result that they want.
Absolutely, I think so too. We'll be back with a look at depression. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Birds with Ballad of the Easy Rider. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. And it's time to talk about depression. We said we were going to talk about it earlier. And in fact, already we've had some comments coming in. PC has WhatsApped us to say that, and I'm going to quote him here, is that each time my brother goes to see the psychiatrist, he has to repeat his story because it's a different doctor. There's no time consulting as the line is very long. There are not enough psychiatrists in our public hospitals. And that perhaps is that also, a big part of the problem that we have.
Yeah, I think a resource issue is a big issue. And also the recognition of the problem, Sharad. So now, according to the ministry, health ministry, a study was conducted last year. It found that just over 18,000 Malaysians suffer from various stages of depression. Now, the deputy health minister has been quoted as saying that the problem of depression was not at a worrying stage, although attention must be given to tackle it. But the larger issue is, is this a hidden problem?
Yeah, and those numbers sound very small to me. I mean, I can't imagine that in our modern life, modern society that we are, with all kinds of pressures, that in fact, depression is at such a low level. I mean, we're a country of over 30 million people. Maybe that's a question of your definition of what constitutes clinical depression. Maybe it's clinical depression that they're talking about.
Okay, the UK has probably a broader definition of it. And apparently in the UK, it's one in five people has at some point of time suffered from depression.
Yeah, so the question, put aside the numbers, right? 18,000 is still significant. It's 18,000 lives that we're talking about. So the issue really is there something about us that stops us from managing this problem better? I mean, is it that we stigmatize not just the individuals, but the whole idea that, somehow, if you're an employer, would you say, if you found on your, when talking to somebody as a prospective employee, that they had a psychological problem, would you say, well, okay, I'm going to be very polite, offer them tea, but I'm not going to hire them?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point, Sharad, because again, because of the stigma attached to depression or psychological issues, your traditional employer is going to, and I think that will be the majority, would stay away from hiring a new hire. But then, unless that person had some sort of you know, fantastic skill or something that they needed, or, you know, other than that, they'd probably shy away.
So the question is, because they think that, you know, when we think of people with depression, we maybe equate that almost immediately with madness, and madness is erratic behavior. Madness is, you know, seen to be equivalent to outbursts of rage. I mean, whatever it is, those stereotypes might be, people go from one to the other and therefore come to the conclusion that somebody who's had a history, even if they're managing it well, cannot be a functioning member of a team.
So essentially, the implication of that is, if I hire this person, he could be a risk to my team and also may not be able to deliver on work that he's supposed to deliver. However, you know, we've got to temper that with the fact that in certain professions, in the creative fields, for example, perhaps people would be a little bit, I would think.
Oh, you think so? Neurosis might be good for creativity. all creative people are on the edge of madness or something like that. Well, okay, so those are the maybe strangely, perversely positive images we have about creatives and madness. Somehow, you know, there's some synergy between those two. But putting that aside, people who have real problems with, you know, and dysfunctions, how do we as a society deal with this? I mean, if you have somebody, for instance, in your family that has mental illness, would you be talking about it? Would you admit to it? Or would you, you know, refer to it? I mean, I know that in my family, I can say quite, I wouldn't say proudly, but I can say without feeling ashamed that there are people in my family that have had mental illness and they have dealt with it and we've tried to help them in dealing with it, right? I myself had gone for therapy when I was feeling particularly depressed. And so I don't think that this is going to lose me a job. I hope not. I hope my boss is not listening in on this.
But the thing is, Sharat, I think probably your family is a little bit more open-minded. There are people that in my family, and the attitudes have changed. 20 years ago, everything swept under the carpet. Today, I think there's a realization that, hey, you need to go and get help.
Well, I don't think my family is necessarily open-minded. I was just saying that, you know, I have come to the point in my life where I think it's important to have this discussion, because I see my friends, Brian, I see my friends struggling with the issues and they don't want to reach for professional help. I mean, what they do say is, oh, you know, what are you trying to suggest, Sharad, that I'm mad? No, I'm not. I don't think you're mad. I just think you might be slightly depressed and maybe a professional can help you. Have you ever thought of seeking professional help, Brian?
I think there was a period of time several years ago, for about 2 or 3 weeks, where I was feeling really, really down. And it did cross my mind, actually.
Yeah, and you should do it. I think it's very, we put so much money into all kinds of things, our health, our physical health, our beauty. But when it comes to our mental health, oh my God, we are so stingy, don't you think?
It's not just stingy, it's just, you know, trying to sweep it under the carpet more than anything else.
Yeah, maybe it's denial. So denial is one part of it, right? Tell us what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM. Thank you very much, PC, for your comments. Now, taking us up to the next bulletin, The Counting Crows with Accidentally in Love, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. The morning run continues. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Thank you very much, Hannah, for your thoughts on the cost of a mental health treatments. You say that in your experience, it is totally unaffordable unless your insurance covers it. And that's an interesting question as well. Do our insurance policies allow for coverage of mental health issues? Now, we come back to some of the issues that are actually global. There's a global conversation about antisocial behavior. Our government is now mulling a special law to empower the relevant authorities to act against those who display such behavior. The Antisocial Behavior Act was mooted last year in the wake of a cycling tragedy which killed 8 teenagers in Johor. These teenagers were apparently out cycling at 3 a.m. So it's interesting. The teenagers are the victims in the sense of the story, but they're also being viewed as the cause of it because of their so-called antisocial behavior, i.e., you know, cycling at late night. The question is, Do we agree, you know, is there a consensus on what antisocial behavior is?
Okay, so let's look at a couple of definitions of antisocial behavior. And that's a wide range. It could range anything from harassment, bullying, insulting, to aggression or hostility towards minority groups, failure to maintain property is antisocial behavior. Abandoning your car on the side of the road can be construed as being antisocial behavior.
Now, in China, whistling, apparently, especially by young men, whistling in public is considered antisocial behavior. So the question is, who gets to define this, define the concept of antisocial behavior? We spoke to lawyer Nizam Bashir for his thoughts on this issue. Now, for some context, we asked him how antisocial behavior is defined legally in other countries which have laws against them.
Well, it generally covers a wide range of activity that causes harm to an individual, community or environment. Examples of antisocial behavior can include nuisance, rowdy or inconsiderate neighbors, vandalism, graffiti, street drinking, littering, dumpings of rubbish, quite a number of things.
So when the Antisocial Behavior Act was mooted last year, one of the things it was meant to do was to control the behavior of minors in public places. Now, do we need such a law to control the behavior of minors or even adults? Here's what Nizam thinks.
Certainly, in terms of minors, we may have essentially laws which are not fully developed in terms of regulating the actions of minors, perhaps not as developed as compared to maybe how it is in some of the more developed countries like the United Kingdom or Australia. Yeah, but to say that there are no laws entirely, I'm a bit uncertain. For example, there are provisions which can be relied upon, of course, to deal with issues like this. If you look at the Minor Offences Act, for example, it has got general provisions dealing with some matters which would be termed as antisocial behaviour.
Since we're talking about children, the issue is that if this law is enacted and children are caught, will they be left with a criminal record that's going to hurt their futures?
I certainly think that, minors, in particular, given the nature of the crime that we are talking about, I mean, essentially antisocial behavior is not as the same as maybe serious crime. So when we're talking about records for minors, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the idea. Yeah. So I think some amount of pragmatism is necessary when looking at this issue. And all I'm just saying, at the end of the day is, we ought to have an open mind about these sort of issues. And, let's just debate and see where the debate brings us on this issue.
That was lawyer Nizam Bashir. Now, the question of mental health also is implied in the story of antisocial behavior. And we turn to lawyer and chairperson for Voice of the Children, Shamila Sacred, to explain how these two things come together.
Absolutely. A lot of children who have mental health issues also have behavioral issues. What we do not want is for these children to be victimized under that law. But suffice to say, I would hope that if there is going to be any new legislation of this form, that they will take cognizance of the fact that people with mental health disorders do exhibit aggressive and antisocial behavior, and that that would be a defense. But also, the flip side, of course, is that people who suffer from mental health issues are victims of other people's antisocial behavior, in particular exclusion, threatening behavior, name-calling, weirdo and things like that. So, yes, we want to be able to protect them as victims, but also them as a perpetrator of antisocial behavior.
That was Shamila Sacrin, a lawyer and chairperson of Voice of the Children, with her thoughts on a new law that's being proposed to deal with antisocial behavior. I wonder if our own impulse, Brian, to always reach for the law as part of as the main solution to such problems is itself suggestive of a kind of society we are, that we've lost faith in local communities and parents and in schools to help, make people deal with society in a better way rather than, go immediately to criminalizing such behavior?
Yeah, I suppose one of an alternative approach really would be for NGOs really to band together or work towards some sort of common objective with perhaps together with the government to come up with campaigns. I know it sounds really cliched, but come up with campaigns to really sort of the issue.
Well, campaigns directed at whom? So would it be campaigns directed at the children? Campaigns directed at adults? Who would the campaigns be directed to?
I think, Sharad, you know, you've got to look at the issues itself to, rather than it being directed, perhaps to identify that this sort of behavior is really just not acceptable.
I hope you don't whistle in public, Brian. We'll be back with a look at the news and with more analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.